very much, Gianna Valcher. I told you you'd get a really good interview.
You did tell me that. Yeah.
I mean, not because Gianna Valcher was talking about us so beautifully. I mean, it's actually, I think it would be, I'd like to come and hear Gianna Valcher introduce anybody, because he it's like a Dharma talk in itself, talking about someone. It's so lovely, so enjoyable, and very enjoyable to be on the end of. And so we're supposed to be having a conversation. A little bit difficult to...
We don't usually converse like this.
No, we don't usually chat like this. And we've also got to take you all into account. I wondered if we wanted to say something about our connections with this place, first off, because we both lived here, didn't we? I came here not long after I was ordained and did labouring work with Attila, trying to teach me how to do bricklaying and plastering. I've said many times, don't look too closely at some of the plastering. The bumpy bits are mine. And you were here. Well, we were. Say what you were doing.
Yeah, well, the project ran out of money after a while, as they do, don't they? And so Sabuti, who was heading the project up, wanted someone to start up a right livelihood business to earn money. So I put my hand up. I'd been working in a cafe in Swiss Cottage. It was actually a squat cafe. Do you remember squatting? So many of us squatted in those days. I was living in a squat spiritual community, as you were.
Yeah, we were hardcore kind of activist Buddhist squatters. I mean, the real deal, you know, properly. Yeah.
And there was this cafe in Swiss Cottage, and I used to work there. And it gave me confidence, because I got into helping to run the business. I ended up running the cafe for a while. And I thought I could run a business, so I volunteered to set up a whole food business. And we called it Friends Foods. And we began by going onto markets. I did Brick Lane Market on a Sunday morning, and Hampstead Heath Market on a Saturday, and Swiss Cottage on another day. And the idea was to build up money so that we could have a shop here. And we used to have a shop. Was anybody around in those days when we had a shop on the corner there, Friends Foods? And then it moved down the road. So that's why I came.
Yeah. And we were ordained before that. We were living in squats in Archway in North London. He was in number 3 Balmore Street, and I was in number 5 Balmore Street. And we got a letter. We both got a letter from Sangharakshita, didn't we?
We did.
One Friday, I think.
I remember, my memory is that he asked, do we want it in June or August?
That's right.
And we said June.
Yeah. And we got a choice, you know. You can either be ordained next weekend or in two months' time.
Next weekend.
I mean, yeah, it was a different kind of ordination training in those days, but we've got the scars to show from our older life. But anyway, we were here for a while. Now, what one of the things I want to say about that is that the whole project of converting the old fire station into a Buddhist centre was called the Sakavati. Well, it wasn't called the Sakavati Project. We just called it Sakavati. Sakavati is now the community, the men's community on the first floor, and the whole place is the London Buddhist Centre. But in those days, it was all about Sakavati. If you said Sakavati, it meant this building site in Bethnal Green, where we were working. Sakavati meaning the happy land, the land of bliss, the land of abundant bliss, which is the name of Amitabha's Pure Land, which is to do with Ratnaguna's book, which we'll get to. So in a way, it's really good, isn't it, that you're here to launch the book this evening? Because there was a very, very strong vision that was around in that time, that the Dharma was not simply about individual development and individual transformation. It was about the whole transformation of society, the transformation of the world even. We were young visionaries inspired by Sangharakshita to create a happy land, and this place was the first place where that was getting really worked out.
It was. It was because up until then, Buddhism was something you did in your spare time.
Yeah.
Most people had jobs and you go to a Buddhist centre in the evening, maybe the occasional weekend retreat, but it was very much something you did when you weren't working or with your family. But Sangharakshita's vision was that it become a whole, you know, everything was Dharma. And so this was definitely part of that.
Mm.
Yeah, and we were trying to change the world, weren't we?
Yeah,
definitely we had that in mind. We weren't just trying to change ourselves, we were trying to change the whole world.
I mean, I went off to India after being here for a couple of years to help Lokamitra start things. So, you know, you went off to Manchester, didn't you?
I did.
To start a centre there.
Yeah.
I don't know what was more challenging, actually, Manchester.
I think Manchester, probably. Yeah. In those days, Manchester was a very grim place to be. Is anybody here from Manchester? No, I can say that then. No. It was very grim. It was really grim. And it's now Cafe Society in Manchester. It's a really nice place to be, apart from the rain. But in those days, it was rainy and grim. So it was a tough place. But I'm sure yours was tough as well.
It's so tough.
About sunshine.
Well, you get a bit bored with sunshine, actually. When it rains, it's so novel. Yeah. Sort of relieved, but let's stay with Sakavati for a bit, the sort of land of bliss, because the Rupa, obviously it's the Buddha, but actually it's Amitabha. It's both the Buddha and Amitabha, but that was very much in mind, and the red lotuses. I think the whole idea of these are the originals.
Aplikas? They look like it. Yeah.
You know, this whole idea that these sort of they're just lovely adornments, but the whole idea is that these symbolise, well, living beings in different stages of development responding to the light of the Dharma coming from Amitabha. So I want to talk a bit about that, because we all knew about, you know, Sakavati, the Pure Land, Amitabha and all that. Mm. But we really didn't really know anything about it at all, did we?
That's about all we knew.
So I guess what I want to ask you is, well, you know, I'd imagine most of you here have come along to the Dharma, come along to Buddhism, well, for all sorts of reasons. But it's about perhaps, you know, meditating, developing yourselves, maybe at first to remove stress, pain, dukkha, difficulty of one kind or another. And maybe the things you've read about Buddhism, the emphasis is very much on, as it were, self-development, self-help even. I mean, the world that you've been in with these, as we say, Pure Land Sutras, it's an entirely different, well, I'm guessing.
It is.
An entirely different way of talking about Buddhism. So there's a load of questions to go with that. So how did you get into this stuff? Tell us your journey to these texts, which, I mean, they're not about meditation. Well, they are a bit, but they describe just a beautiful world with a fabulous Buddha in it and people transform.
Yeah.
What's that about? Because that doesn't sound like the Buddhism that most people have come across and which they enjoy and love so much.
That's right. It's a very different form of Buddhism and one that I think many Western Buddhists would not recognise and perhaps even dismiss, I think. So I'll just answer the first bit of your question, was how did I get into them? I got into them through a Japanese teacher. Some of you may have heard of him, called Shinran. Medieval times, 11th, 12th century, who had been a monk in a Tendai monastery. Tendai is one of the, as you know, one of the great schools of Chinese and Japanese Buddhism. And he'd been a monk living in a monastery. I think he was a shrine room attendant. So he spent a lot of time in the shrine room. And after 20 years of practice, he gave up in despair. He thought he was getting nowhere, and he gave up. But he didn't give up Buddhism, but he gave up what he was trying to do as a Buddhist. The way he was going about it just wasn't working. So he left that monastery and he came across another monk called Honen, who had had a similar experience. And Honen had come across Amitabha. And there was a line in one of the sutras that really hit him. What Honen did was he spent ages and ages in the monastery library reading through all the texts, trying to find an answer to the problem that he had, which was similar to Shinran. It wasn't working for him. And he came across a line, and I can't remember now what the line was, but it's very much to do with the whole emphasis on the sutra, which is surrender to Amitabha rather than work from your own power, your own motivation. So Shinran found out about Honen, became one of his disciples. So I read about this when I was at the study centre in North Wales. I was living there and teaching there. And I had a similar experience. By then I'd been an order member for about 20 years, and I didn't know about Shinran or Honen at the time, but I came to the conclusion that I was getting nowhere. I just was getting nowhere, and it was very depressing. And I gave up. I did actually give up and left that Buddhist centre and went to live in Llangollen, a town nearby, and worked for the Inland Revenue. And then the NHS, and then back to the Inland Revenue. And I spent, as you know, it was a big crisis for me. I spent a good couple of years out of things and had no contact really at all with the movement. Slowly I came back in, but Shinran was a very, very big figure for me. He meant, for obvious reasons, he meant a lot to me. So I began to study Shinran and try to understand him and his form of Buddhism, which is all based on these three sutras. But I found the sutras very, very difficult to get into, but I really liked Shinran. So it is an odd experience to be like a follower of Shinran, but I didn't really like what he was into very much. But years later, on a solitary retreat, I took the sutras with me, and I read them out aloud in front of the shrine room. And then I understood what they were about. They weren't meant to be sat and read like a novel or a book on science or something. You don't sit in an armchair and read these texts. Or you can try, but I suppose I could ask you to try and see what happens. But they didn't really work like that. They're not meant to be read in a solitary fashion, I think. They're really ritual objects. They're meant to be read out loud. You can either read them out loud yourself or listen to someone else reading them. And as you read them, you're not really meant to use your thinking mind. They're not. They don't tell you much about the Dharma. There aren't really any teachings there. They're just descriptions of this fabulous, sensuous place. Which has a very strong effect on you if you open yourself up to them. So read all three sutras in front of the shrine on this retreat, and I remember thinking, I could give a series of talks on these sutras, having read them. And I thought, I could give a series of eight talks, rather like Sangharakshita had given a series of eight lectures on some of the other Mahayana sutras, the Vimalakirti Nadesha, the White Lotus, etc. And I actually planned out the talks in a notebook. And then I came back to wherever I was living. Can't remember where I was living at the time. And of course, you know, life is busy, and I put the book in a drawer and I forgot about it. Until I went to Guhyaloka 3 years ago, and the idea came back to me. And I didn't have the book with me, so I couldn't refer to that. But again, I thought, I could write a book on these three sutras. So that's what I decided to do.
We'll get into the sutras in a minute. I want to go back to what you were saying about Shinran after 20 years, you know, feeling you hadn't got anywhere, and you feeling you hadn't got anywhere. Because I'm sure that's something that people feel from time to time, that you know, you've been practicing and practicing and practicing, and you sort of feel that, well, nothing's happening. You know, we can feel that we get stuck. And you mentioned... You mentioned that, you know, Honen, Shinran, the verse they discovered kind of described something to do with surrender.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, in a way you have to sort of give up. Mm. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that as a what you've learnt from that, because you're not, you know, a total follower of Shinran and Shin Buddhism. But you know, what does that mean for you? What does surrendering mean in the context of the way in which we practice the Dharma?
There's a certain amount that you have to do for yourself. You have to get yourself along to a Buddhist centre, unless someone drags you along, but that usually doesn't happen. So you have to find out where a Buddhist centre is and go. So that is volitional, that is self, isn't it? You're doing that. And then you have to decide you're going to start practicing, and you practice, don't you? You start being a bit more ethical and noticing when you're being unethical and trying to correct that. And you meditate. Most days, hopefully, you meditate and you pick up books and read them. And all that's you doing it, isn't it? And I did that for about 20 years. I did all that. And I got a lot out of it, I must say. But I got to a point where, I suppose you could, there's a law of diminishing returns, where I felt in the early days I was getting a lot out of doing this, practicing. And as time went by, it seemed that any progress I was making was slowing down. And it got to the point where I felt that I'd stopped. You could put it in terms of hitting a wall, but the way I described it at the time, I remember talking to a lot of people about it, I felt that I was slowly being strangled.
Wow.
That I couldn't breathe, you know. I just couldn't breathe properly. And I didn't know what to do. But I was feeling quite a strong aversion to those things that in the past I'd felt a very strong attraction to. Mm. Things that used to work for me no longer worked for me. Mm. And I was also, I was a member of the Preceptors College Council, one of the 13 members of the order that Sangharakshita had kind of handed over to. So I felt like I was in quite a big position, and I was also a well-known speaker and so on. And so I felt that people were looking to me and looking up to me, but I knew what I was like. And it felt like only I knew that. I knew the kind of thoughts and feelings that I was having. The thing is, as you know, because you are a very good speaker, that when you're giving a talk, when you're in a situation like this, you're at your best. And I'm more or less at my best now. But I'm not like this all the time, and you don't see that. You don't see the other bits of me, you know, when I'm having an argument with my girlfriend, and when I'm waking up and I don't feel like doing anything, and etc., all the negative states I get into. They're not on show because they're not present when I'm in front of a bunch of people. But they are there at other times, and what I felt was a great tension between how people were seeing me. They saw me at my best and then just assumed that I was like that all the time, and I knew that I wasn't. So there was this great tension arising within me between what you might call my public face and my private. And so I realised that actually I couldn't make any more progress in the way that I was going about things. And I didn't know what to do. So what I did is I withdrew and I went somewhere else. And it took me maybe 2 years to realise that that's the way of it. That's the way of the spiritual life. That you can only go so far with your own volition. And then at a certain point, you realise that that's about as far as you're going to get to on your own. And now it's time to do something else. And I didn't realise that. I went and worked in the Inland Revenue instead.
And, surrendered to the Inland Revenue.
Yeah, and that was not a good experience. What I realised after about 6 months was it didn't solve anything. I was still the same person with the same problem, but this time working in the Inland Revenue, which was not a good place to be. So I slowly came back into the movement, but I had to do it in a very different way. I remember watching Michael Palin did his Himalaya trip. Anybody see that? I watched that on the TV one day, and there was one time he was in some Tibetan town, and he was talking to camera, and behind him there were these nuns prostrating. They were on their way somewhere, prostrating all the way, and they were all behind him going like this. And the impression I got somehow from that little bit of TV was the way they went about it was very different from the way that I was trying to do it. I was trying to become enlightened. And the way the impression I got from that program was that's not the way they did it at all. That they lived in the Dharma. They gave themselves up to the Dharma and they just let the Dharma have its effect on them. So the way I sometimes talk about it is if I were to do a gesture, I was doing this, trying to get somewhere. And they, and I think Pure Land Buddhist, do this. Yeah? They let it happen to them. So that was a big learning for me. And so I came back very, very slowly, carefully back into the movement because I didn't want to make the same mistakes. And I just thought, well, this is me and I've done my best and it's not very good, but it's the best I can do. And so I came back in a much more, how can I put it, less ambitious, much more humble, much more realistic way of living this spiritual life.
Didn't Shinran have a name for, instead of talking about being a bodhisattva, gaining enlightenment for all beings, or didn't he have a particular name for the best state of a practitioner?
He did, and I really relate to this very much. He called himself a bombu.
A bombu.
A bombu, yeah.
So tell us what a bombu is.
A bombu is an extremely foolish person. So the ideal for Pure Land Buddhists, Pure Land Buddhists don't really believe that they can become bodhisattvas. That's much too exalted for Pure Land Buddhists. They become bombus. Yeah. And it's a fantastic place to be because if you just admit to being a complete and utter idiot, you can't do anything, there's nowhere to fall. Yeah. So it's just like, well, of course I made a big mistake there. Of course I didn't give a very good talk. What do you expect from me? And it takes all the pressure off. And I really enjoy being an extremely foolish person.
Yeah.
It really suits me very well.
Yeah, I mean, not about you, actually, about myself.
Yeah.
It reminds me of a lovely, you get these, there's a particular devotional verse in Tibetan Buddhism, of Nyingma Buddhism, where it opens with the wonderful line, Kema, which is a kind of expression of sadness, of sorrow, Kema. Buddhas and bodhisattvas, have compassion on us Dharma charlatans who fill the land. And I think that's so good. You know, you're putting on a show of it, really. But that's seen as a very positive realization, you know, knowing that you're pretty hopeless.
Yeah. And
sorry, folks.
So, Pure Land Buddhism really is the path of where you do your best. You practice ethics, you practice meditation, you study, you practice spiritual friend, but you also realise that you can only go so far. In my various studies, I've become very interested in faith in other traditions. And there's one tradition which I really like, which is there's a man called Gregory of Palamas, who's... anybody heard of Gregory of Palamas? He's Greek Orthodox, medieval again. And in the Christian tradition, there used to be, I don't know if there still is, but there used to be a debate about works and faith, works and grace. How do you get to heaven? Do you work your way to heaven? Do you earn your place in heaven? Or is it given to you by God? Yeah, some of you are nodding, so you're used to this idea. So there was this big debate. And Gregory of Palamas said... he came up with a kind of fusion of the two, and it's due to him that we've got this word synergy. You know the word synergy? There's a synergy between us. You know that idea? Yeah, you usually say that with an American.
It's from a Prince song.
Probably, yeah. I can't help saying it in an American accent.
Yeah, we can funk, I think.
Yeah, there's a synergy between us. Yeah. This comes from the Greek Orthodox Church, and the idea is that you did your very best as a Christian, but in the end, you could only go so far, and then God took you as you were. So there's this sense of synergy. You're both working away. And I really like that. That really works for me. So even when I do the Metta Bhavana, I have to say, I ask Amitabha to do it for me.
Right.
So I say, look, would you just direct love to him, please, for me?
Yeah.
And to him and her. And it's great for the enemy section because you can... I'm sorry, I can't direct love towards that person. Can you do it for me? And they do it through me. So Amitabha does it through me.
Right, okay. This is quite, quite important because I'm sure many people coming along to the Dharma here this evening have been very attracted to the Dharma because it's, you know, strongly, militantly, even non-theistic.
Mm, yeah.
You know, that there isn't a creator God, etc., etc. And what you're sort of saying a bit about, you know, Amitabha there and, you know, the whole business of these Pure Land Sutras, and we must get on to you describing them at some point, these sutras. But, you know, this thing of surrendering to another power, to, you know, asking for help in metta-bhavana. So how does that fit with the Buddha's teaching on no creator, God, and that sort of thing? Is there a conflict here? Have we got a conflict going on between early Buddhism, which seems to put a lot of emphasis on the individual, you know, going forth, making enormous effort, and is this a sort of degeneration in Buddhism, of a Buddhism of faith and devotion, where you've got the Buddha sort of almost deified or something like that? So that often comes up, doesn't it?
He does. If you were to look at the ancient Pali texts, I think you could make a case for saying they don't really fit. The ancient Pali texts and Pure Land Buddhism doesn't really go together. Although there are parts in the Pali Canon, as you know, that do go along with this. But as a whole, if you read the whole Pali Canon, you were going to be really balanced. I think you'd have to say that the emphasis in the Pali Canon is on self-effort. You know, this idea of the Eskimos have 32 words for snow? I think there might be as many words for effort in the Pali Canon.
Yeah?
There's many, many different words for striving and effort and so on.
Yeah.
And the Buddha, you know, there's a famous line, isn't there, where the Buddha said, you know, Buddhas cannot do the work for you, you have to do it yourself. Mm. So there's this strong emphasis on
that. By you must the zealous effort be made.
Exactly.
Buddhas only show the way. Yeah.
One thing we have to remember, though, that form of Buddhism, the form that's preserved in the Pali language, and which the Theravada, the school called the Theravada, came from that, is only one school among many from that period.
Yes.
We know there are at least 18 schools, don't we? Yeah. We know that from the Pali Canon itself, from its own debates with some of the other schools. And we know that some of the other schools were very different from those. For instance, there's the Lokuttara of Ardins. Lokuttara means beyond the world, and they believe the Buddha to be beyond the world, that he only appeared in this world to be a human being.
Mm.
And the reason the Pali, we've only got really the Pali Canon in its fullness, the other schools died out, and that's because the Pali Canon went to Sri Lanka, and it was preserved in Sri Lanka. Meanwhile, the Muslims invaded India, and they burnt everything. Mm. They burnt all the texts, so none of those other schools really survived. So where you could say, you know, a strict Theravadan would say, oh, Pure Land Buddhism isn't really Buddhism, must be a degeneration. That's only looking at it from the Theravadan point of view. But even in the Theravada, as you know, there are hints of giving up to other power. And have you ever given a talk on Pingya?
Here? Not here, I don't think so. Might have.
Anyway. There's Pingya. Well, I've been talking quite a long time now, so why don't you say a little bit about
I'm enjoying what you're saying.
Well, Pingya, an old... were you just about to start? Pingya, an old man, a Brahmin, goes to see the Buddha with 15 other Brahmins, and they ask him lots and lots of questions. It's a fantastic text, isn't it? Just asking lots and lots of questions of the Buddha. And then they go back to their teacher, Bhavari. And there's this lovely section at the end where Pingya is just talking about the Buddha to his teacher and saying, what a fantastic man he is. And Bhavari says, well, if he's so great, why don't you spend all your time with him? You know, just go and live with him. And Pingya says, I don't need to. I'm with him all the time. He's in my mind's eye all the time, and I'm bowing down to him all the time. And then something even incredible happens, because Pingyi has left the Buddha where he was. He's gone back to wherever Bhavari lives. And he's telling Bhavari about the Buddha, but suddenly the Buddha speaks to them both. And he says to Pingyi, "That's great, go, go, with the power of faith." What's the Pali? Do you remember what the Pali is about?
The Pali is, you will be liberated through this faith. Let this strength liberate you.
Yeah. And he says, he mentions three other people, Vakali and two others, who have gone to the other shore. The other shore is enlightenment through the strength of their faith. So he gives Pingyi a way to gain enlightenment through faith.
What's interesting about that sutra, I mean, one of the things I find really interesting, and a number of things, is that it's very, very, it is very devotional. It's a man recollecting his teacher, the Buddha. It's actually incredibly human, isn't it? It's not turning the Buddha into a sort of god. It's the kind of thing that you would do with a really good friend. When you have a really good friend, somebody you love very deeply, even if you're apart from them, they're kind of with you. And I don't mean just sort of, you know, that horrible, dreadful attachment sort of feeling that you have where you're not with them and you're thinking about them, but it's painful. There is a sort of positive fidelity that you can have, I think, in love and friendship, where you're sort of carrying the person with you sort of thing in a very, very positive way. In this case, it's the Buddha. He carries the Buddha. He recollects him, remembers him with all the emotions associated with the Buddha. And it's as if the Buddha has become alive through his recollection, doesn't he? And there's a lot of wisdom actually in that verse, because he talks about the teaching that the Buddha gives. And I find that interesting that you've drawn that out to make that link with these sutras, because for me that's a very human, it's a very, very human story. A man remembering his teacher, a human being remembering his human teacher, and that having a transporting effect upon him.
And I think that's really important with the Pure Land Sutras, because I make the point in the book that I think the reason they came about is because the Buddha had died and they missed him. Mm. They missed him as a person. And they needed somehow to feel a sense of the kind of contact that Pingyi expressed so beautifully in that text. They wanted to try and have that kind of contact. So how would they do that? So they began to visualize the Buddha. And of course, once you start doing that, it kind of takes over. I don't know if you've had this experience, but you're doing a certain meditation practice, and if you really get into it, if you really become concentrated, it has a life of its own, and it takes you places that you weren't really expecting to be taken. So I think what happened is the early Buddhists, after the Buddha's death, they began to recollect the Buddha in the way that Pingyi recollected him. And after a while, the Buddha that they recollected began to become a real person to them. So that not only were they relating to the Buddha, but that Buddha that they were remembering, imagining, began to relate to them. And there's in the third of the three sutras, what it says, the Buddha says, is that if you visualize Amitabha over a period of time, what will happen is he'll begin to teach you. So you can actually be taught by Buddhas as you're meditating. Now, for some of you, this might seem really outlandish and strange, but I think for those of you who've been meditating for some time, you don't need to take this literally, that there's a Buddha called Amitabha who's going to kind of break into your mind as you're meditating and give you some teachings.
It's a shame. Could take it literally.
Well, I do.
Yeah.
I like to take it literally. Well, in a way. I'll talk about that in a moment. How literally. There are different ways to take that literally.
Yes, literally.
But another way of understanding that is you begin to listen to your own deeper wisdom. Mm. Yeah. Now, I know at the weekend you were talking about this and you didn't particularly like that way of thinking about
it.
You gave a talk where you were talking about this and you were saying that people think of it as their own self they're listening to, but actually you much prefer to think of it as actually the Buddha who's talking to
you. Yeah, I do. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah. But I'm in a different mood this evening, different moment. But one thing I want to go back to there, so you've got the parinibbana has happened. Unless you were an enlightened disciple of the Buddha, you wouldn't feel actually the Buddha had gone. I mean, that's why the enlightened disciples of the Buddha don't get upset, not because they're cold-hearted, you know, unattached. You know, a lot of people think unattachment is being completely alienated from human feeling, which it isn't. But enlightenment hasn't gone out of the world for them. You know, enlightenment, in a sense, the Buddha hasn't gone away. But for the unenlightened disciples, it's absolutely catastrophic. You know, imagine it. You know, if there was a Buddha, you know, if Gnanavacha, Maitreya Bandhu, if they became enlightened, you know, and you kind of knew that they were Buddhas, and then, you know, they suddenly entered Parinirvana, you'd feel really upset because you'd feel that enlightenment had gone out of the LBC. Well, you know, the enlightenment wasn't there. So there's this tremendous feeling of absence, isn't there? Mm. The absence of the Buddha. And what you seem to be saying is that the whole imagining of the Buddha, to use that sort of language, is a response to the absence of the Buddha. Of course, some people would say, well, surely that means they're just excessively negatively attached. I mean, how positive can that be, if you see what I mean? How creative can that be?
Well, reading the sutras, they're totally positive. Mm. Totally and utterly positive. There's a throwaway line in them. The sutras aren't meant to depress you, they're meant to cheer you up. And they do cheer me up when I read them. I feel very happy as I'm reading them. And they draw a picture, not only of the Buddha, but also of this imagined land. Maybe it's time we came on to the imagined land, because for some people that seemed very, very strange. Let me just say a few words about the imagined land, the Sukhavati. So the ground, depending on which of the three sutras, because the picture drawn in each of the sutras is slightly different from each other. But in the shorter Sukhavati Viyuha Sutra, the ground is golden, completely golden. And there are lotus ponds, and the lotus ponds are lined with golden sand. Not sand that looks like gold, like on a beach, but sand that is made of gold. And there are lotuses in those lotus ponds, and the lotuses are about the size of a cartwheel. And they're described very beautifully in four colours, deep blue, yellow, red and white, which those four colours in that order goes right back to the Buddha. Maybe more of that later if we remember. Mm-hmm. And then there are trees. The place is filled with trees, but they're not trees made of wood. They're trees made of gold, silver, lapis lazuli. Now, I've discovered in my talks that not everybody knows what lapis lazuli is, but it's a semi-precious stone, deep blue in colour, with golden strands running through it, and crystal or quartz. And in the longer sutra, they're also made of sapphire and ruby and emerald. And in fact, in the longer sutra, the trees, there's a number, the description of the trees goes on for a number of pages, because you get gold trees, silver trees, etc., seven kinds of trees made of different jewels or whatever. And then you get trees with golden roots and silver trunk and lapis lazuli boughs and crystal branches and sapphire leaves and ruby fruit and emerald flowers. Yeah, that's
what were they taking?
And then the next kind of tree has silver roots etc., etc. It goes through all the combination. It goes on like that, and it's tedious to read. You think, yeah, and when are you going to finish it? Because they're not meant to be read. They're meant to be visualised. They're meant to be imagined. So the whole thing, many, many other things like that, but tremendous, gorgeous imagery that you're supposed to just really try to imagine.
Mm. Yeah. Imagination. Yeah. Is that a good thing? Of course it is. I know it is. But
well, there are different kinds of imagination, of course. But interesting, I've got five lovely endorsements of the book. And although I've called the book Great Faith, Great Wisdom, most of them write about imagination in those endorsements. Because, you know, when you're writing a book, what you have to do is you have to think about what you're going to say first and put together a book proposal and send it to the publishers. And then you also need to come up with a title. So I thought that the book would be mainly about faith, and I decided with this title, Great Faith, Great Wisdom. But as I was writing the book, the imagination became the main thing that I was writing about. And imagination and faith being actually the same thing. Mm. That when you're feeling faith, you're imagining. Mm. Yeah. So really the book is about the path of imagination as a path to awakening. Mm. And in a way, awakening being the awakening of the imagination. Mm. Mm. And one of the things I've been saying recently is that we, Western Buddhists, often think of the great turning where you get to the point of what we call irreversibility, where you can't fall back from the path, stream entry or whatever. We think and talk about that mainly in cognitive terms. Let's say I said to you this morning, oh, I had an insight in my meditation this morning. You probably think, oh, you learned something. I really learned this morning in my meditation that all things really were impermanent. Yeah, or that there really is no self, no enduring self. We think in those terms. But as I was reading the sutras, there's hardly any of that in them. Hardly anything at all. They're just not interested in the self and seeing through the self. They're just not interested. It seems to me what the texts are doing is they're laying forth in front of you a path of the imagination. And just imagine if our path of Buddhism was a path of awakening the imagination. Mm. So instead of saying to you, oh, I had an insight in my meditation this morning, I said to you, I had a moment of illumination.
Mm.
Yeah. Or my imagination was woken up this morning. It would be very, very different.
Well, you actually mentioned an image that you saw, or you used a metaphor to communicate what you'd seen. Because the whole, I mean, if it's really insight, it's actually beyond words.
Yeah.
It can't actually be articulated by any kind of concepts. It's a takavacharo. So.
Yeah.
In that sense, to describe enlightenment or the realm of awakening as a realm of jewel trees and lotus ponds, in a way is more accurate, isn't it?
It is
accurate. It's more fitting.
I think what they're doing is they're painting a picture of an enlightened mind. Yeah. They're not saying the world is really like this. There is another sutra, the Vimalakirti Nidesha, where the idea there is that this world is actually a pure land, but you don't have a pure mind, so you don't see it that way. Yeah. But I think these sutras are different. They're not trying to say that the world is like the world painted in the sutra, but they're saying an enlightened mind is like this. An enlightened mind is a mind. The best way to put it is it's as if trees are made of gold and silver and lapis lazuli, and it's full of lotus ponds. And one of the things I've been doing as I've been writing the book and then afterwards is I did, you know, practice the sutras, because I think the sutras are practices. And I imagine myself walking down into the ponds, walking down this graded sand down into the ponds and letting the water go up to my knees and then my hips and so on and so on and so on. And what is that water? Mm. The water for me is the water of the purified imagination. Mm. So you come up to your neck and there's just one more thing to do, and then you just let yourself go right in and you just plunge in to the purified imagination. Mm. Fabulous thing to do.
Mm.
Yeah.
Now there's a meditation for you.
Yeah, great.
Plunging into the purified imagination. Mm. But it's also interesting, I started by talking about the hangings. Mm. Because, of course, the Buddha's vision after his enlightenment, where he's asked by Brahmasambhati to look again at the world, he uses an image to describe the living yes. beings he sees with his Buddha eye.
Yeah.
It's not any ordinary eye. It's not even the eye of profound meditation. It's his eye of enlightenment. Again, if it's the eye of enlightenment, you can't really... It's beyond language. And what he sees, the only metaphor he can give is that living beings, human beings, are like beautiful lotuses, white and red and blue, growing in a great lake.
Yeah.
So, you know, if a Buddha came into this room, he wouldn't see us the way we see each other. It would be an entirely different vision of something like lotuses.
Yeah.
A great beauty and purity and, well, also this sense of emergence.
Yes.
Moving in the direction of enlightenment.
And there's another meditation in the third sutta that I really like. There are 16 meditations you can do in the third sutta, and one of them I really like is you imagine yourself in Sukhavati, but within a closed lotus.
Huh.
Yeah, you're in with a closed lotus. And what that means is you're cut off from the Buddha and the whole beauty of Sukhavati. You're in there, but you're also not in there. You're in there, but you're kind of cut off. And that, to me, is a beautiful... description of what it's like to be unenlightened, to have the Buddha's teaching, but somehow you can't quite get at it because you're cut off. So you imagine yourself, you're in Sukhavati, but you're also in this, closed within this lotus. But what you do is you imagine the lotus opening, and as the lotus opens, you begin to hear the birds singing the Dharma. And the rivers going past murmuring the Dharma, and divine musical instruments that are floating in the sky playing the Dharma too. So you begin to hear, before you couldn't hear it, so it opens up and you begin to hear. And also you open your eyes and you see Amitabha, the Buddha. And you realise you're with all these beings, all these bodhisattvas, who you were kind of cut off from. I see the lotus as a kind of sheaf of selfhood, kind of protecting you. You think it's protecting you, but it's also preventing you from everything in life. So it slowly opens up and you open up to everything in the Pure Land. It's a tremendous thing.
Incredible image, isn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing. Just to finish, I've got this fantastic great big picture of the Pure Land on my wall. And there's all these figures in it. There's some beautiful stuff in there, but it's full of beings. So one thing we haven't spoken about today is Sukhavati as a metaphor for Sangha, spiritual community. And right down the bottom, there's this lotus pond, and there are these lotuses. And there are beings on it, on each of those lotuses. And some of them are little babies. They've just been born in Sukhavati. You've got these lovely little babies just been born in Sukhavati. It's very sweet. But right down the bottom, there's this tiny one, and there's this person. It's the only person in the whole picture with his back to you. Yeah, right at the bottom. And it's easy to miss. But who is that person? That person is you, visualising Sukhavati. And the interesting thing about that is when you visualise Sukhavati, you're in Sukhavati. You're not out there looking at Sukhavati, you're in it. And you're there... The lotus is opened up and there you are and you're looking straight at Amitabha, the Buddha, and all the bodhisattvas, 34 of them all ranged around him. This fantastic sangha and the pagodas and the palaces and the bridges leading from pagodas to palaces, and above that, beings in the air, on clouds, streaming through the air, their robes streaming back, these coloured robes streaming back, and musical instruments floating around in the air. It's this fantastic kind of vision of what enlightenment is. Wonderful.
It's 9:30 and you said...
Maybe another...
Go on a bit more. Where'd you go after that, though? That's amazing. But Sangha, that's interesting.
Because,
Sangha's, it's so lovely, isn't it? So important to practice with one another. So am I right in thinking that that is one of the reasons why you'd want to go to Sukhavati?
Indeed,
that?
So in the first, the shorter of the Sukhavati, the shorter Sukhavati Vyuha Sutra, the Buddha describes Sukhavati to Shariputra, describes it, and then he says, you must cultivate a heartfelt desire to be born there. Then he gives one reason and one reason only for that heartfelt desire, and that is because when you're born there, you'll be with all these other beings who are irreversible from enlightenment. That's the only reason he gives. He doesn't say because it's beautiful, because you'll be able to float around in lotus ponds and, you know, all that. He says, because you'll be with all these other beings.
Mm.
Tremendous.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a restatement, in a way, of the time when Ananda came up to the Buddha and said, you know, I've been thinking, I think spiritual friendship is half of the spiritual life. And the Buddha said, no. It's the whole of the spiritual life. And that's a restatement of that, I think. The whole reason to be born in Sukhavati is because you can be with these great beings who are well on their way to enlightenment. You can join them.
So you could even say the whole reason to practice, I mean, trying to sort of translate that into our own experience, is not about our spiritual progress. It's about to join with others in love and friendship, living the Dharma life together.
Yeah.
Going into that ocean of Dharma life for the benefit of others.
Yeah, and that's going back to the Michael Palin TV programme. That's what I saw.
Yeah.
I saw these beings, these nuns going past behind him. And I thought, they just live within the Dharma and within the Sangha. They have their whole being in that kind of... The whole context is there for them. Yeah. There's no need to do it all on your own.
And in fact, trying to do it on your own is self-defeating. As you know, as you've discovered, as I've discovered, you know, that having all that sort of pseudo spiritual ambition that can come in is actually you're defeating the whole purpose of Dharma life. You know, if it is getting beyond the ego or seeing through the self, that what that looks like is love, doesn't it? What that looks like is you opening to love flowing through you and opening up to love in others.
So I think very often Western Buddhists, and that includes many of us, I think, we think of it in self terms, and I am going to gain enlightenment, and then I try to see through the self, and it all becomes very to do with me, and your very efforts to try and go beyond the self keep you connected with the idea of a self. And what the Pure Land texts, they just don't bother with the self. They just say, there's the Buddha. Give yourself up to the Buddha. Forget yourself, basically.
What a relief that is.
Yeah, what a relief. It's a blessed relief.
God, so boring, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, the self is boring, isn't it? That's one of the aspects of self which is great dukkha, I find. I get really bored with myself.
Yeah. You get bored with being fascinated by oneself, don't you?
I get bored with my thoughts and my smell and the things I keep saying over and over and over again. You think, oh God, not again. It's so good just to forget about the self and give oneself up to something else.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think we ought to be giving ourselves up to
time?
The next.
So let's take a very, very big.